Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is November 26th, 2022, and this is episode 354. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames, here in Rochester, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warnerd, Gary Bretcher, a.k.a. John Dolan, in Trieste with a sore mouth. I don't know if you want to say anything about that or get to our interview. Or...
Ow.
Yeah, that's what I said. Ow, when you told me the story. Anyway, it sounds like your mouth is better despite the dentist breaking your teeth.
Well, it was one of those stories. I think a lot of people have this story where the dentist tries to pull one of your teeth and it breaks off, and then it becomes a matter of digging, and he's digging in your own mouth, your own personal mouth.
You can really hear it in that inner ear when they're doing that, right? Like, and it's, even if it's
it doesn't
numb,
hurt at the moment, but you know it will later. So I ended up with a big giant bruise on my face, and it keeps getting bigger and changing colors. And I have to say, that's the one payoff for something like this. I mean, I don't mind it as much as other things, like nausea. You know, nausea doesn't show at all, but it's the worst. I'll take just about anything except maybe itching over nausea. But this, you get a nice big bruise out of it, and people flinch away from you on the street, which I always wanted. So,
you should say to them, you should see the other guy.
Yeah.
Of course, that's a dentist, and you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we have a great interview with Lyle Jeremy Rubin, author of Pain is Weakness Leaving the Body, about his joining up the Marines and going and serving in Afghanistan during Obama's big surge there. It's a great interview, and let's get right to it. Okay, we are really excited to have with us Lyle Jeremy Rubin, author of a new war memoir and sort of coming of political age, I guess you call it, memoir, Pain is Weakness Leaving the Body. First of all, great title. For a book. Lyle is also, he's an Afghanistan war vet, as we'll hear, and has published in several publications, including New York Times, Washington Post, N Plus One, The Nation, and also got a PhD, and I see it now here in your bio here, a PhD up here at the University of Rochester. So first of all, Lyle, thanks for joining us on Radio Warnerd.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the interview.
Yeah, definitely. There's some things here that, I mean, really, it's a memoir about war, about, you know, the global war on terror and your part in it. But it's also really a memoir about political awakening, I guess would be the word. And for us here, it's a kind of a familiar political awakening because, I mean, and very different circumstances, but still a familiar trajectory. John and I've talked about this a lot in the show, and we've written about this, you know, plenty and plenty over the many years about being young, reactionary war nerd twerps who sort of eventually were, I don't know, what's the other version of mugged by reality, conned by reality or something, you know, by the right, and kind of woke up over time and moved leftward.
Yeah. In fact, to me, the old cliche, which I'm sure we've all heard to the point of nausea, like, if you're not a leftist at the age of 20, you don't have a heart. And if you haven't become a rightist at the age of 40, you don't have a brain. That strikes me as exactly wrong. Yeah. I was a rightist with all my heart for a lot of reasons. But eventually I suppose you'd call it cognitive dissonance just weighed in and collapsed the whole structure. And that was a rational process.
You know, there are certain characteristics here of the classic sort of war nerd. I mean, there's a big difference. There are a lot of differences, but there's some things that I saw in the book too that also were very familiar. Like, for, you know, you describe pretty painfully scenes of being bullied, A lot of war nerds have been through that. Mm-hmm. You played Risk in high school. That is an absolute necessity to be a war nerd. You know, become a reactionary Republican. First sex late in one's life that compared to cool people. You know, a lot of things like that. A war nerd make. So, you know, first of all, before we get into your war experience, let's talk just a little bit about where you came from and the world that sort of made you. I mean, you come from a upper middle class Jewish American family in West Hartford. First of all, we know you changed a lot of names in the book, but John and I both looked up your high school because you name it in your book. And you have a character in your book named Luntz. And Frank Luntz, the Frank Luntz, went to your high school. And I'm wondering,
I'm glad you caught that.
John and I both were like, hey, look at that. Yeah. What gives? What's the story behind that?
So it is a pseudonym. I mean, I'm not actually calling out Luntz there, but I did the character that the person that character is based off of always reminded me of Frank Luntz. And I did know that Frank Luntz was from my hometown. Right. So it just kind of came intuitively. I thought it would just be kind of a joke to myself that no one else would ever get. But I'm glad that you got it.
It's perfect. I mean, it is a perfect kind of pseudonym anyway, isn't it? Luntz. Yeah. Luntz said it's for that kind of character too.
Yeah, wasn't Luntz an Animal House? I like that kind of name.
How did growing up in West Hartford sort of inform your earlier politics and your desire to join the Marines and stuff? Because it's not like California, where everything's supposed to be liberal and everything, the general ambience was definitely liberal, you know? So if you were a reactionary, it put you in a world that was very alien, that didn't exist around you, you know?
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to say that, like, I struggled with the whole writing of my childhood bit. Prior to writing this book, I really had limited experience writing about myself. I mostly wrote political historical pieces, and I didn't find my childhood all that interesting. I still don't. But I did think it was a somewhat useful childhood, given what I'm trying to do, which is basically kind of implicate more than just the warfighters in the broader war-making machine. Mm-hmm. And having come from an upper-middle-class background and a kind of town that traditionally, at least the past half century, has been, or really throughout the Cold War, has been very supportive of centrist U.S. foreign policy, I thought it could be helpful for me to write about, you know, where I came from. Mm-hmm. The other piece of this is that this is a town that was very attracted to a kind of Clintonite or even George W. Bush kind of politics, somewhere mildly center left or mildly center right. But also most of us that lived there had very little experience with people that had been in the military or were in the military or were planning to be in the military. So for me, I write about this as honestly as I could. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on in my own life that made me kind of a perfect target for the recruiting shop in the Marine Corps. I was bullied. I was sexual bullied. I came from a loving household, but one in which, you know, my father was often very intimidating and, you know, there was always kind of like a threat of violence, even though rarely did it actually culminate in physical violence.
Well, that was only because you were able to beat him to the fence, as I recall.
That was a good scene,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I guess I was definitely looking for some type of path that would make me feel like I could defend myself. The Marine Corps, for me and for a lot of people and the military in general is a place in which you can find that kind of sense of security, and self-defense.
Yeah. I just have to interject here. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm from a literature background and I particularly love Wallace Stevens and Lyle, as I'm sure you know. He was a Hartford guy. Mm-hmm. And your project to show that this obsession with masculinity of a really destructive kind goes way back and covers areas of the culture that might not be directly associated with fighting a war is shown in one of Stephen's poems, which is called Of Hartford in a Purple Light. And I'll just read a bit of that. It is Hartford seen in a purple light. A moment ago, light masculine, working with big hands on the town, arranged its heroic attitudes. But as in an amour of women, purple sets purple round. Look, mater, see the river, the railroad, the cathedral. I assume these are places in Hartford. But he first says, you know, there's this antithesis of masculine light working with big hands and heroic attitudes. And then this sort of hint of lesbianism, but as in amour of women, purple sets purple around, because purple light is somehow inherently female. He later compares the light to a poodle and to various French things. And the whole complex of what is masculine and what is feminine is, you know, and you can just imagine Hartford saying, look, Stevens, the sun's going down. Just walk home and forget about it.
Yeah. Does that sound...
That's great. Thanks for...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'd have to think about that a little bit more. But first of all, one of my mom's favorite poets is Stevens. And I actually have yet to really sit down. You know, I've read a few poems here and there. But now I guess from here on out, I will devote myself to the oeuvre of Wallace Stevens. But no, that's great. I think there was also just something about, I ended up moving around sixth grade to the other side of West Hartford, which happened to be on the border of the West End of Hartford. And there was just like such a clear, like it was technically a border, but it was substantively a border as well. I mean, the moment you cross that street, it was Prospect Avenue. You know, everything changes. The demographics change. I mean, it's West End is actually a fairly nice part of Hartford, but still, you know, everything's relative. And I guess I always had this sense that things were different on that other side of the border. And yeah, I mean, at the time, I certainly wasn't thinking of it in masculine or feminine terms. But I guess there was a part of me that sensed that I was soft, that I came from somewhere soft, and I felt a need to become hard.
At what point did you get into politics? I mean, you described how you were into theater, and it sounded like you were good at theater.
I mean, theater was like my life, and I thought I'd become an actor. But it was around the same time that I was kind of, you know, just doing theater 24/7. To the extent I wasn't doing theater, I was hanging out with this group of kids who, you know, smoking a lot of weed and just doing a lot of dumb shit around West Hartford. And these were the guys who ended up being fairly abusive with me. And I guess for whatever reason, I mean, certainly just the culture I found myself in, I ended up identifying my connection to theater as, you know, one of the reasons I was getting bullied, that I was being seen as not manly or womanly or girly in some way. And I ended up like basically abandoning theater while I was still in high school. I happened to become friends with this right-wing Jewish kid, fellow Jewish kid in West Hartford. And, you know, I started like, it was a pretty radical transition. I became an observant Jew overnight, but I also became a listener of Rush Limbaugh.
This is through the Jewish guy. This is the guy whose character's name is Micah in your book, right? Yeah,
Micah, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So that was really where the political shift happened. And so I started writing pieces for the high school paper at the time. I started organizing political debates. And I became a, you know, conservative presence in the high school at that time.
You have a quote in your book from Madeleine Albright from 1998 that I think sums up the way in which moving from Clinton centrism to military right wing is not so big a journey. So I think everybody should hear this quote. This is Madeleine Albright, 1998, talking about further sanctions and raids on Iraq. And she says, "If we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall and we see further than other countries into the future. And we see the danger here to all of us. I know that the American men and women in uniform are always prepared to sacrifice for freedom, democracy, and the American way of life."
Would you like to know more?
Yeah, you have a lot of quotes in here that really surprise me. And I think you do a really good job of weaving the whole context, not just the war fighting point, but the whole background culture into this militarist tapestry, if you like. And Mark and I were saying when we were talking about the book, like, we don't remember Madeleine Albright talking like that, but there it is.
I remember the Iraqi children dying is a price worth paying quote.
Yeah.
But I don't remember, like, that was sort of like, well, maybe she kind of, she was horrible, but, you know, maybe she sort of wanted to not lose an argument. But this was a very positive imperial, I mean, this is just standard, like, militarist imperialist blather. It's pretty amazing. I'm surprised we don't know that particular quote quite. I know the indispensable nation, I've kind of heard that around, but I don't see people quoting that quote nearly enough.
I was about to say that an indispensable nation has become like a trope. I mean, I think there's books with that title that come directly from that interview. But yeah, you're right. I think a lot of people took away that those two words without returning to the quote as a whole, which I think there's a lesson to be learned there that, like, the moment that you assume that you are the indispensable nation, then all the other corollaries to that, particularly the imperialist, you know, hubristic corollaries of that, naturally come with it. And I'm thinking of George Packer's most recent essay in The Atlantic. I don't know if either of you read it.
I didn't, but I saw people saying he's the worst writer alive after it. I haven't read it yet.
I mean, he's certainly one of the most insidious writers of our time, I would argue. I mean, he speaks very much in a liberal, even, you know, left-leaning tongue, but it's often to either maintain or renew this sense of indispensability on the part of the United States. And that's more or less what that piece does. It argues, you know, despite everything that's happened, throughout the war on terror, despite the rise of Trumpism. In fact, it's not even just despite, because of all this.
Right.
Exactly. The indispensability of the United States has proven its necessity even more. And, you know, he would argue that you can have this notion of national indispensability without all the horrors that have historically come with it. And I think what I, you know, ended up learning as a Marine, and as just a human being at this moment in history, is that you can't. That the moment you see yourself, either as an individual or as a collective, as being the kind of indispensable component of this larger whole, in this case, the globe as a whole, from then on out, I mean, a politics of domination of some kind naturally proceeds from that.
And also, everything is justified. That advances your power because your power is indispensable. So it's just perfect circular, you know, like pseudo-moral reasoning to just justify every single thing you do because you're indispensable. Yeah. But it's interesting. So, you know, thinking back to the Clinton years and that era, I mean, the divide was basically between people who thought Clinton and Albright and these people were effete, decadent, effeminate, liberal. America was too decadent, not manly. I remember there was a big thing about manliness in the 90s and the sort of the 2000s. And your book captures a lot of that anxiety about manliness, particularly on the right. And but my God, when you read and remember anyway how the Clinton presidency actually was, I mean, they were vicious and bloodthirsty as anybody. Tell me if this is right, because this is my memory of it. I remember sort of how the right kind of transformed through the 80s. As in the beginning of the 80s, it was really all about getting the Cold War with the Soviets and getting a war on with the Soviets again and overcoming that side of American decadence. But by the end of the 80s, it was Alan Bloom, neoconservatism, which a lot of it was about this anxiety of like losing manliness, becoming decadent. Not that Alan Bloom wasn't decadent, you know, famously. And I left in the 90s, but I remember going back and reading about a lot of the things that the neocons were writing about, and they were obsessed with manliness or Americans losing manliness. They're obsessed with homosexuality. I think people forget this about the neocons. Especially people like Norman Podhoretz and, you know, Crystal's father, Irving Crystal, and probably William Crystal too. Like, a lot of them were very obsessed with sort of homosexuality as a disease or as a problem because it cut into manliness. How big of a thing was that in your sort of time as a reactionary?
First, I just want to say that it is interesting. I think there's something to be said for the fact that Alan Bloom was gay. And I also actually think not just among neoconservatives, but I think, that this was a time when the New Republic had Andrew Sullivan at the helm.
Right.
You know, who's also, you know, one of the first kind of mainstream gay, you know, commentators. And, you know,
by the way, I'm sorry to cut you off. When I said decadent, I didn't mean because he was gay. I mean, because
of
the
course.
Stories, no, the stories about the dungeons and all that stuff. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, but
which is fine,
but
I guess too.
But I mean, Andrew Sullivan, his legacy at the New Republic was, you know, moving the magazine to the right. Sullivan's politics then, as of now, was this kind of masculine queerness in all respects. And it was actually always linked at the hip with, you know, a masculine kind of racialism or even arguably racism.
Yeah.
There's a great book called Manliness and Civilization that covers similar themes during the turn of the 19th century, during the rise of Theodore Roosevelt and really when, like, you know, America comes into its own as an imperial power. And it just, you know, it's a very forceful argument for this sort of thing that when you're talking about masculinity at the level of a civilization, it is always connected to a kind of racial masculinity or a racial self-aggrandizement. So I think both among neoconservatives and also among neoliberals in the 90s, there was this search for a new kind of masculinity and a new kind of racial politics, although often, if not always, unspoken, that would present the United States or represent the United States as this kind of strong, necessary, manly force in the world. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just humanitarian, it was him.
Right.
That reminded me of one of the most shocking moments of my time as a writer, because, I mean, I was already too old to have serious thoughts about this, but when the Second Gulf War began, I was talking to somebody at UC Berkeley, and like a lot of male undergraduates, there was a very stylized gender distinction there. I think both men and women were becoming right-wing, but women sort of pretended to some extent that they were still liberal. The men pretended they were bloodthirsty, and there was a lot of flirting involved with it. But this guy had been among the most bloodthirsty advocates of the war. And then talking to him privately, I said, well, are you going to join up? And he said, he laughed. I mean, he laughed very innocently, like, no, of course not. I mean, we send, you know, volunteers from poor cities. And your book contains those stats about who goes and who doesn't go. But that shocked me because I was kind of an old school reactionary, like, you know, you're supposed to go. I mean, that's a rule.
I wonder how that affected you too, how much that might have been something that started to break through, you know, the cognitive dissonance that the whole chicken hawk phenomenon during that period, during the W period. Like, were you able to just fully edit it out the way I remember editing out all the sleaze of, or, you know, it built up over time, but all the Reagan era sleaze and corruption and just how full of shit they were about everything. And you just kind of edited it out. But the chicken hawk thing, I have to say, was pretty effective in terms of like, wait a minute, how can that be? How did that affect your politics, or did it?
So I will answer that question, but I did want to mention the role of Saul Bellow in my book, because I think he's also related to what we're talking about. Like, I came from a center-left Jewish family, and Saul, so I naturally was reading a lot of Philip Roth and a lot of Saul Bellow, but this was a time, the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was still in high school. You know, Bellow had recently been unearthed. You know, it's this notorious quote about, are there any Proust, of the Hutus?
Tolstoy's Among the Zulus in that one.
Yeah. Right. And like, Bellow's whole kind of aesthetic was this very like masculine literary intellectual vibe, which is, I think, is related to what you're asking about chicken hawks. I think, as someone who spent a brief time in this kind of neoconservative policy orbit, I think that is more or less what they tell themselves. Like, we don't need to pick up the actual rifle. We're manly enough to do the kind of manly writing that's required of a war.
Right.
I think Bellow kind of embodied that aesthetic.
Right. Yeah, you talked about reading Ravelstein, which was his sort of Ramona Cleff about Alan Bloom, right? If I remember.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, you describe your political awakening was this guy whose name in your book is Micah, who's Jewish, who I appreciate the pro-Sephardic stuff in your book, coming from a Sephardic background myself.
And oh, nice.
A lot of pride. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, he's very right-wing and very pro-Israel. And this is something else that is very different from when I was young. When I grew up, when I was a reactionary, I was also, you know, very pro-Israel Zionist. And the First Intifada kind of broke that for me. But when I was young, I think this is mostly an American phenomenon among American leftists, but Israel could do no wrong among American liberals and leftists. They were the darlings because they were socialistic and had a tight identity and had suffered. And I, you know, back then they could just sort of edit out what the Israelis were doing to Arabs. And, you know, that became complicated after the First Intifada, and then over time started changing. And what else changed was that a lot of young American Jews started trending very hard rightward, in line with Israel's politics, actually. And that made more sense because left-wing American Jews started to question what the hell Israel is doing in the occupied territories and to its own Israeli Arabs. You come across this a lot, as far as I can tell, in your generation, and you're influenced by it, sort of young Jewish males or young Jews who are very both right-wing and very pro-Israel, and the two kind of become intertwined with the war on terror. Wanted to see what you thought about that, or if there was much left-wing Judaism when you were younger that would pull you the other way at all.
The answer is no. I mean, from my perspective at that time, there were two options. Which I think, unfortunately, is how a lot of Americans still see things, although things have been changing a little bit lately. Either you're a Republican or a Democrat. And it was the same with Jewishness. I mean, either you were, you know, a Republican Jew or a Democratic Jew. And when it came to the stuff that really mattered, whether it was Israel or U.S. empire or capitalism, you know, we all agreed. You know, there were different inflections, no doubt. Like, I would say someone like my dad, who, you know, was a Zionist, still is a Zionist, it was, he would emphasize more the kind of Israel as a safe haven. And I found as I moved right, yeah, sure, Israel's a safe haven, but also, you know, Israel is where the real Jews are. That's where the that's where the real men are.
Right.
And that's what I first started hearing, you know, a kind of a very like disdainful take on American Jews and diaspora Jews. That, you know, that we were soft and that we were effete and so on. And I guess that was another reason I felt like ultimately I had to pick up a rifle, not just to prove my Americanness, but also prove my Jewishness. And both were synonymous with a kind of manliness.
Did you ever think of, you know, going to Israel because of that? Or was your Jewish identity not as important as your American right-wing identity?
I thought about it, but I think it was somewhat, I mean, it was fleeting. Like my friend Micah would, you know, once in a while talk about making Aliyah and ask me if I wanted to do it. And I would say, yeah, I'll think about it. But, you know, I was only in that world for a few years. Who knows if I had stayed in that world, maybe at some point I would have headed over to Israel and lived in a settlement somewhere.
Right. you go to Emory and it sounds like you were still not serious enough, I guess you'd call it, or what they would call it, right? About, I don't know, careerism and that sort of thing, but you were serious about your politics, it seems like. And after Emory, you decided to join the Marines. If you could tell us sort of what made you choose Marines and sort of how that initial process started.
My grandfather was a Marine during World War II. He fought in the Pacific and he actually got shot in the head at Iwo Jima. Like basically the same day he landed on the beach. His friends, his two best friends got killed around that time, and he survived. I mean, he got had a metal plate in his head for the rest of his life. He was in a coma for a very long time, but he was able to regain most of his physical and mental capacities. Never had feeling in his left hand, always had to speak somewhat slowly, but ended up starting his own business and really became kind of the patriarch of my mom's side of the family. And he was a wonderful guy. I mean, and we all looked up to him and he was my hero. So when I had made the decision to join the military, it was kind of just a natural, it was a natural choice to pick the Marines. And then as far as my first experience at OCS.
What's OCS again?
Officer Candidate School. So you have, for those who might not know, you have boot camp for the enlisted ranks, which are the majority of the military. And historically in militaries, they always had these two-tier structures. I imagine most of the people that listen to War Nerd probably know this, but you know, that's the, speaking in the language of the old aristocracies of yore, the enlisted were the masses, and then the officer ranks came from the aristocracy. Obviously, in a democracy, it's a little different.
How did you get in the officer's training program? Did you have to go through ROTC in school?
No. So I had already gotten my degree at Emory. So I had a college degree. That's really the only baseline requirement, is that you have a college degree. There's also other ways to become an officer through the enlisted ranks. But usually like 99.9% of the officer corps has a four-year degree at this point, I believe. Yeah, so I had a college degree. I had to pass a physical test in advance, an academic test in advance. I had to have letters of recommendation. There were a few other kind of secondary or tertiary requirements, but the big one is just having that degree. So I actually was, you know, I was very physically fit. I was smart. So I probably was going to do pretty well on the academic part of the training. I didn't have any leadership experience. I didn't, you know, most of the guys that go to OCS were athletes, either in high school. I would say a good chunk of them were college athletes as well. A lot of them were leaders, you know, on their teams. So I didn't really have any leadership experience. And I think that's what really hurt me the first time around. I wasn't a leader and I the whole culture.
And you weren't a jock.
The military.
I mean,
yeah, I wasn't a jock. Right. So yeah. I was a bizarre kind of outlier in a lot of ways. I was very bookish. I was Jewish. Yeah. There were a few of us there. I write about some of them in the book, mm-hmm. but. It was a terrible experience.
Yeah.
At the time we had a colonel who literally would walk around with a piece of straw in his mouth. And I just remember him muttering more than once, I don't want that candidate in my gun club. he loved talking about his gun club. To his credit, he really believed in what he said, and he ended up getting fired for it because this was 2006, so it was the height of the two-front war with Iraq and mm-hmm. Afghanistan. And he refused to basically produce or manufacture enough Marine officers. So the civilian leadership was telling him, the attrition rate needs to be this percentage, right. and he just ignored them. so there was something like, I might be exaggerating a little bit, but it was – I think like 2/3 of those who showed up didn't make it all the way through. It was just like 1/3 that were making it. And the civilian leadership was saying at least half have to become officers in each class. So it was just a no holds barred, arena at that time. And basically the weapon of choice for the sergeant instructors was sleep deprivation. And there were no rules concerning sleep deprivation. So what they would do, which is very funny in retrospect, although it was really painful at the time, is once they targeted someone and they were like, all right, we're going to get rid of them, all they really have to do is sleep deprive you. Because, eventually, it doesn't matter how good you are. I mean, eventually you're not going to be able to function. So, So they basically just assigned me like 3 or 4 essays a night I have to write every night while everyone else is sleeping. And basically like... you can't have a single error. You can't have a spelling error. You can't have a grammatical error. You can't have a spacing error. And they would just keep on marking up my essays and being like, okay, here are 3 new essay assignments you have to write.
That was one of the most surprising things in the book for me. Like I used to teach composition. And I think of that as a punishment for the grader, not so much for the writer. And these guys in the Marine Corps were doing it. If you see them, tell them for me, I was a little disappointed.
I couldn't say that they were the best grammarians or school marmy teachers, but they got the job done. I mean, they marked all it required is 1 mark, and then they would be like, okay, you have to rewrite this on top of the 3 new essays you're getting. So basically, it was basically telling you you wouldn't get any sleep. And this went on for, I really lost all sense of time, but it went on for, I believe, at least a week. Maybe even longer. And I really had what I think is akin to a psychotic break. And I ended up, I guess technically I ended up, it was during the jousting competition. So I had one of these poles, in kind of
one of the poles that's padded at both ends.
Exactly. And actually it's also very funny in retrospect where, in the beginning, you kind of charge at the guy, and then you're supposed to lunge forward with the jousting stick. But in the process of lunging forward, I actually twisted my ankle. So I twist my ankle, I feel this pang, and then I just get hit, really hard into the left cheek at the same time. I'm on the ground within seconds, and that's it. I couldn't do anything after that. So,
I mean, sleep deprivation is one of the basic forms of torture for, I guess, legal torture as we define it, but like Guantanamo or wherever, to break a person.
Has been for a long time. When they couldn't get a confession from a witch, they just do provision. Mm. And I suppose this also involves the fact that they're not allowed to hit you anymore, right? So you describe a lot of spitting on you. Because I guess that was somehow allowed.
So officer cadet school was a bit different than boot camp. So I ended up going to boot camp after that. I was invited back to officer cadet school because I actually, interestingly, I had refused to quit within a certain time period. If you can drop on request or quit within the first few weeks. And then after that, they reserve the right to kick you out. But for the first few weeks, they can't kick you out. And I refused to quit. And because of that, they saw potential in me and said, you know, I could come back. But I was, I mean, it was such a difficult experience for me. I was just terrified of Quantico after that. So I eventually, you know, I basically healed. They paid for me to get, you know, therapy on my ankle, physical therapy. And I ended up going to boot camp at Paris Island, you know, so I ended up going through the enlisted ranks for a little bit.
Right.
And, you know, there were a lot of major differences in the training. Right. And one of them is just that the enlisted ranks, you know, like I was saying earlier, are mostly housed by people that come from the lower middle class, the working classes, also poor people. I mean, the economic demographics of the military are actually more complicated than a lot of people think. It's, you know, we hear the poverty draft a lot, and there were definitely poor people. But I would say the kind of the bulk of the military, especially the enlisted ranks, I would say are kind of like lower to middle class, but it, very working class. I mean, the middle class in this country has been so hollowed out. That if you're in the bottom 60-70%, I mean, you're struggling. So that was really the heart and soul of the Marine Corps, and I think it still is. But because of that, this class difference, the officer ranks tend to be more middle to upper class, middle to upper middle class. You know, there's just more that the instructors can do to you and get away with it. I think there's some fear, either conscious or subconscious, at officer candidate schools. If they mess with you too much, particularly physically, you know, someone powerful, a powerful parent might get involved at some point. So anyways, at boot camp, you do have, at times, at least when I was there, there was, the instructors actually would hit you, but they were very careful about it. I mean, they knew, you know, never to hit you in the face. They didn't want any kind of visible bruising. So a lot of times it was pushing and shoving and, you know, pushing you into something hard, like the metal portion of your rack, your sleeping rack, all sorts of other stuff. But yeah, one thing they definitely spit in your face a lot, and like real like Hockey Louie type spitting. So your whole face is just dripping with their phlegm. And then on top of that, they had a few designated hitters in the platoon, other recruits, and they would order these recruits to hit on their behalf.
Like the big Greek. That was one of the really interesting things.
Yeah.
They had this guy they called the big Greek who would hit people for them.
And there was a scene that reminded me a lot of kind of the Full Metal Jacket scene with Leonard, where the guys took the, you know, wrapped up the soap in the towel and held him down and beat him. That you had a scene sort of similar to that in your book.
Usually it's soap with a piece of towel around it, but yeah, this time it was baby powder.
And held him down with the blanket in the same way and stuff.
Yeah,
and you almost got snagged up in it. But yeah, you do. You make a really, really interesting point. In fact, you know, we often talk on Radio War Nerd about what's wrong with the officer class. And you have it's a very obvious, but a lot of times the best observations are kind of the most obvious ones that need to be repeated, which is this huge kind of political, I guess, difference between how the enlistees, the grunts, whatever, are trained and the political environment of how officers are trained, which is essentially hardcore individualism, meritocracy versus a kind of completely submitting yourself to the collective.
Yeah, so I talk about going back to officer candidate school the second time. I make it through boot camp. I go to my military occupational specialty school, which is I was basically being trained to be a system administrator for the air wing. It wasn't a lot of fun. And, you know, like I said, I was invited to go back to officer candidate school. So after I went through that school, I ended up going back to Quantico. And during my second time, I'm starting to think a lot more about the class dynamics, and I make it through officer candidate school. I go to the basic school, which is the follow-on school for officers. And, you know, one of the really striking things, if you're coming up the ranks from the enlisted community, is just there's just a kind of very transparent individualism among the officer class right off the bat. I mean, it's people are talking about their own track, their own trajectory within the military, in much the way that law students talk about their own track, you know, within law school, or medical students talk about it within medical school. Because that's more or less where we come from. I mean, if we're not joining the Marine Corps officers, we're going off to law school, medical school, business school, something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, there's gestures, kind of very, I would say, somewhat skin deep gestures to solidarity and the group and the unit in officer training, but it's not nearly as present and it's not nearly as felt as it is among the enlisted. At least this is how I perceived it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have some really interesting passages about people doing their creds in the way that, you know, first year dormies will exchange SAT scores or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like others hewed closer to their geeky essence, going on about digital network intelligence or tailored access operations. Some went with their language chops, which ran the gamut from Korean to Spanish to French to Russian to Arabic to Farsi to Dari to Pashto. They conveyed their linguistic versatility with the same pride they did their past or present gigs. Yeah, that sounds very grad school.
So interestingly, that quote comes from I was writing about my enlisted guys once I made it to Radio Battalion, which was I was in a signals intelligence unit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're absolutely right that was definitely like the feel of the officer corps. But I happened to be in a unit which was somewhat exceptional, where I was with basically the smartest guys in the Marine Corps. A lot of them were being trained to be linguists or, you know, kind of technical mavens. A lot of them ended up in cybercom years later. So, you know, and a lot of them already had been to college. Some of them even had graduate degrees. So it was unique in that sense.
Yeah, the Marine Corps stereotype that we get is more like something you've described later, where there's a kind of almost boasting about loserdom, like where you say they appeared just as eager to relay stories of perceived failure, which were boundless and pensive, disordered and proud. Quote, I can't control my liquor. Quote, I dropped out of college. Quote, I used to be over 300 pounds. And, you know, I've seen sessions like that where eventually it becomes a one-up thing.
Those passages, I'm really just trying to convey the appeal of this type of community in a way. I mean, even to this day, I feel like there is a kind of honesty in this type of community. And I would argue that we don't need war to foster this type of honesty or this type of community.
You don't need the Afghanistan part.
Don't need to kill millions of people just to come together. But
I mean, we laugh at this, but you know, one of the most common justifications I heard for why we need basically militarism, not just a military, but militarism among fellow Marines and among others that kind of support the military status quo in our society. And I even hear it to this day is that, well, we need all this in order to have a sense of purpose and a sense of solidarity, which to me is just so dark and depressing. Like, you know, they can't even imagine maybe having like a labor movement or
people helping out other people. Like, what the hell's wrong with you, you weirdo? No, we got to come together. And like in the movies, that was really well rendered. I have to say in your book, how wretched and intimidating your first experience at Quantico was. And then you kind of went through all this experience and, you know, lived out in
29 Palms.
29 Palms, that's it, yeah.
Haven't you ever heard that? Who was the guy from Led Zeppelin? He has
I know, Robert Plant.
29 Palms! Yeah.
You mentioned that in the book.
Yeah.
And then you go back to Quantico your second time and you're much more able to deal with everything. I mean, and I guess that's how it was in real life. I mean, I would have thought that your first really horrible experience at Quantico would have been when your belief in the things you thought you believed in, the right-wing militarist politics, would have really started cracking. But it actually didn't crack until later. It was sort of a slow process, actually. Or it was sort of brick by brick, right?
One way I've gotten to describe this is that I think what Quantico did is it shattered me. Like, I had a real sense of being shattered in a way I'd never had before. I mean, it really humbled me. I mean, I came from a charmed, you know, upbringing. And suddenly I have all these enlisted Marines screaming at me every day that I'm a rich kid who can't do anything. And so my whole sense of self, whatever self-regard I had, just went out the window. And, you know, I was feeling that to a real extreme extent. But I wasn't ready yet to make sense of it in a healthy way. If anything, the shattering made me want to prove myself even more. So I felt like, you know, I had lost this round, but I was still going to win the overall game. Like, right. I was still going to go back. I was going to prove all these instructors wrong. And interestingly, when I went back to Officer Candidate School a year and a half later, one of the instructors in my platoon was still working there. And I had no idea. I had no idea he was working there. And it was toward the very end of my time there, the second round. And it's clear that I'm going to make it. And he suddenly comes up to me in the chow hall and he says, "Candidate Ruben, congratulations." And like shakes my hand, pats me on the back and says, "You know, I'm so proud of you." And then just like disappeared. And I actually invited him. I through someone else, I invited him to come to my graduation. He ended up coming. So I did see him at the graduation as well. But but yeah, I had that kind of moment very much in mind. I saw myself as, you know, Rudy in that movie, that the small. Yeah. So that I was somehow going to come back and prove all these people wrong. So,
right.
But it wasn't until later. Yeah. That I ended up not just feeling the shattering, but kind of like making sense of it intellectually,
right.
And kind of asking myself, like, why did I put myself through this in the right. first place? And like also just questioning the environment that I found myself in.
Right. So it's not like that experience left you just because you defeated it, so-called, right. That experience still was very deeply embedded in you. Like, it was painful.
And then they do send you to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So that was also a remarkable part of the book. This is the later part of your book after you describe your early experiences and then your training experiences. And then I guess you were deployed to Afghanistan in 2010?
That's
during
right.
the yep. Obama surge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To Helmand province.
You ended up actually in the beginning... You were in Nimruz province, just west of Helmand, in a place called Delaram?
Yes. So Delaram was there were two regiments, Marine regiments in Helmand. One was in the southern section of Helmand and the other was in the northern, although technically it wasn't actually in Helmand, it was in Nimruz. So I was part of the northern regiment. We call them RCTs. I forget what it stands for, but that was kind of my headquarters. That's where all my analysts were. And for the first half of my deployment, I was the assistant platoon commander. So I was the number two. I was the second lieutenant. And then I had a first lieutenant in charge of me. And it was my job to actually, I spent some time on the watch floor at the regimental base, but I spent a lot of time traveling from one remote outpost to another where our team Marines were. They were the Marines that were attached to the frontline units, usually infantry units, artillery units that were functioning as infantry units, other combat arms units like combat engineers, tanks that were also functioning as infantry units, and then sometimes even special forces units. And I would go to these remote outposts and basically, you know, I would account for all the gear because we had a lot of expensive gear that they were using. And then occasionally I would go off on missions with them. And this was mostly taking place in Helmand province proper. So I spent most of my time, at least the first half, like in Helmand, and we were operating north of Marja. So Marja was the main effort. That's what was in all the newspapers. Mm-hmm. General Nicholson, who was the commanding officer at the time, I believe it was him who said we were going to bring democracy in a box to Marja. And General McChrystal had taken charge recently. So there was all this idealistic talk about finally succeeding in the counterinsurgency mission. And what I was experiencing north of Marja was basically all these fighters that were getting drained out of Marja were just basically moving north to my area of operations and doing everything they were doing in Marja now in places like Musa Qala and Nawazad and eventually Sangin. So it was really just a lot like the Vietnam War. I mean, it was, we were just moving the battlefield from one place to another.
Mm-hmm. So you were in charge, basically, your job was to manage a bunch of people. Were they all men or was it men and women?
It was all men.
Okay. A bunch of men who were trained in Pashto or Dari or one of the languages and were listening in to Taliban communications?
Yes. So at the watch floor, we had the analysts at the regimental base, which was very cozy, big chow hall. There they would be mostly paying attention to the traffic of mid-level to high-level commanders. So they wouldn't just be using cheap radios. They'd be using satellite phones and, you know, you can guess every other kind of communications we had, we were listening in. And then at the remote outposts, it was called indications and warnings. So these guys were basically going out on foot patrols every day with these frontline troops and listening in on ICOM radio traffic, which is like kind of the cheap radios that the fighters were using. And they were just listening. We could geolocate more or less where they were, where the fighters were. We could, my guys could translate on the spot more or less what they were saying and kind of just give regular updates to the squad leader, you know, if there's any threats in the area, what the intentions are, you know, are we about to get ambushed? Are there IEDs in the area? Intelligence along those lines. And then whenever a Marine would get hit by an IED or if there was a firefight and a Marine got hurt or killed, the troops in this particular area naturally would want revenge and they would usually turn to my guys, the SIGINT guys, to get as much intel as possible to basically give them a location that they can go to and just basically just blow shit up.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that for in terms of the cliches about the Afghan war is that we're told again and again that the U.S. Armed Forces can't do languages. They especially can't do the languages you need in Afghanistan. But it sounds like your guys were pretty good with the languages.
My guys ran the gamut as far as how good they were. But yes, I mean, I was continually impressed with how good they were. Mm-hmm. And my best guys, I mean, were really good. And really good in more than one language. I mean, most of them were either translating in Pashto or Dari. I knew some guys knew Baluch, and I believe in some maybe were even trained in Tajik a little bit, although that really didn't come in handy in the southern part of the country.
Right.
But it did come in handy with the Afghan soldiers that we were working with, a lot of whom came from the north and were Tajik speaking.
Mm-hmm.
The Defense Language Institute is, at least when I was there, it was pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mark and I have talked about how in terms of learning Russian, which I tried to do at UC Berkeley, and which this was during the Cold War, and it wasn't very good, frankly. Defense at Monterey, you could just say Monterey as a metonymy. It was where the people who got really fluent came from.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to, like, oversell it. Like, definitely, I do remember, you know, just in the course of talking to you about this, that a lot of my Marines complained that they didn't get the education they really needed and that they, in fact, they weren't prepared for their job. But I, you know, they definitely learned a lot in the field downrange. I mean, they, like at first, I think a lot of them were struggling, but the quality of the intel got pretty good, at least from my perspective. So, yeah, I mean, they did what they had to do. Unfortunately, right. Involved imperialist occupation and right. Killing a lot of civilians.
One of the really enjoyable and I think valid things about this book is that you discover a lot of guys who are sort of quasi geniuses who happen to be from loser backgrounds, like Walker, this guy you describe who just casually speaks about 9 or 10 languages, and he's from this messed up place in Chicago where they, you know, everybody carries baseball bats around, but he's incredibly smart.
Yeah, so I mean, Walker, I mean, obviously I had to change the name and the details. But yeah, I mean, I became very close with him while I was in Afghanistan, and even after we both got out of the Marine Corps. And, you know, all this stuff is based on what he told me. So it's hard sometimes to figure out what's embellishment and what's not. But he definitely came from a tough neighborhood. A lot of the guys did, and it was very much part of their identity. A lot of these guys were very much hybrids. I mean, they came from tough neighborhoods or just, you know, places where they had to be tough, and, also were incredibly smart and incredibly competent. And it was interesting working with them. I don't know, you know, I only worked with Radio Battalion. You know, I did, throughout my time in Afghanistan, I got to know some of the grunts as well. And they were also very interesting in different ways. But Radio Battalion in that sense is very interesting. It's really this, you know, just super smart guys that also have all the habits of mind that you would think Marines have.
Yeah, I think I saw something like that once because I went to a Russian language program in what was then West Germany. And a lot of guys from what was then the Berlin Brigade were there. And I came there. They were very, very smart, and their Russian was much better than mine. But at the same time, you know, I had all the mannerisms of somebody who was a Berkeley pseudo-intellectual, and I'd pick them up for my own defense, you know, to seem like somebody who was entitled to teach. But they really resented that. They didn't like that at all. Yeah, and yet we were fellow intellectuals, I felt, but no.
I have to ask you, did you hear or personally sort of see anything to do with the human terrain systems? We've talked about this on the show, and we had a personal connection to the person who started up. John wrote some really great articles about human terrain systems, and it was this sort of counterinsurgency boondoggle that had some horrible consequences, but founded by somebody we knew back at Berkeley. Did you come across that at all? Human terrain systems, basically anthropology PhDs put into villages and getting acid thrown on their faces and things like that.
Yes. I mean, that's interesting. I'd love to hear more maybe offline about your relationships with the human terrain teams. But yeah, I came across them. I wouldn't say like often, but I occasionally did. I remember I became friends with one of the human terrain guys who was at one of the bases that I was at for a while. So we would have lunch together. I remember them not having a good reputation among the actual Marines. Mm-hmm. I just heard a lot of Marines would often kind of speak of them derisively, that they weren't giving any real useful intel. Of course, the Marines like to speak derisively of everyone who is a Marine. The Marines, it was their job to, at least where I was, to kill. It was the job of the human terrain teams to win the hearts and minds. So, right. Of course, there'd be tension between the two. And I remember they seemed like, I came across different human terrain teams throughout my year in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And there was definitely like, there were times where I was with teams and I think they'd only been there like a few months or even a few weeks. And there was a kind of idealism to them. And I remember being with other human terrain teams where they were just as jaded as I became. And they didn't believe in what they were doing at all.
There weren't a lot of jobs for anthropology PhDs. So,
Especially that high paying.
Yeah. I thought I'd read a brief passage, a very funny one in a grim way, where you're trying to do the hearts and minds as well as the hardcore military stuff. You're patrolling a village with the interpreter who's an LN, a local national, and he's interpreting conversations with the village men. So about an hour later, the questioning is complete. The kids are still spectating. I get off my knees, now sore, because you were mounting guard, and I guess you do that in a kneeling position, and approach my lance corporal, a linguist. How do you say, we want peace? Mushram kwaram. That's what I hear, at least. I walk over to the three brothers and hand the bar to the oldest. Candy bar, I think. I've been waiting an hour for this. Mushram kwaram, I say. He smiles and nods. Not quite sure if I said it right. Not quite sure if he understands. In any case, he removes the gum from his mouth, a gift from another Marine on patrol for sure, and offers it back. No, thank you, I say. I wave goodbye. He waves in turn, puts the gum back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's exactly as it happened, because I remember writing feverishly in my notebook when I got back from that patrol to kind of record that. But I mean, there were so many moments like that, and I mean, it's very funny, it's very dark, it's very embarrassing that I would even think of saying something like that in that context. But, you know, it's almost like I knew. I mean, that was fairly early in my time in Afghanistan, but I almost knew at that point that this mission was just so ass backwards and that, of course, we weren't bringing peace, you know? And I felt like I maybe was overcompensating by, if I say I'm bringing peace, or I say that I'm wanting peace, somehow that will counteract the reality of the situation, which is that we're, in fact, bringing war.
That was the big shock for me. Reading this, that you were there, I guess, 12 years ago, and you describe general sort of pervasive awareness that this mission had no point and it wasn't going anywhere. Like, everybody seemed to know that.
Yeah, I honestly cannot remember a single conversation with a frontline Marine who believed in the mission.
God.
I remember some conversations with usually officers that were on a big base somewhere where they believed in the mission. But I cannot think of a single Marine who was, you know, actually engaged in the, you know, the fighting or the walking in the minefields, who, you know, believed that we were going to win this war in any kind of decisive sense, that we could win the hearts and minds of the people. In fact, it was the opposite. It was emphatically and transparently the opposite, where the universal understanding among the frontline guys was that the people there didn't want us there, that they hated us, that the Marines hated them. You know, there was all sorts of racist words passed along those lines. I mean, like everything else, there was probably a range within this general judgment. So some people would be a little more humanitarian about it. Others saying, you know, the previous, once in a while I'd hear like, oh, the previous battalion commander was among some of the smarter guys on the front lines who were actually somewhat interested in the counterinsurgency mission. They would say something like, oh yeah, the previous battalion commander was trying to, you know, move, the battle space in a more, you know, counterinsurgency direction and was making some successes, but now this new battalion commander came in and it's all just kill, kill, kill. So there were moments, some kind of recognition that maybe at some point it was moving in the right direction, but it always came quickly followed by the recognition that it's no longer moving in the right direction. But usually you wouldn't even hear that.
I have to repeat, that was 12 years ago. It's stunning how long Afghanistan went on. And then when Biden finally, as you put it in the book, ripped the Band-Aid off, there was screaming about him doing that, when seems like everybody knew for more than a decade that there was no point to this.
Yeah. I mean, you basically, you get a very clear sense pretty early on, especially again, if you're going to the small outposts, that the only reason this is continuing is because of the various combined self-interests of officers and of civilian leaders and of contractors and of the wider military industrial complex. I mean, the Marines, you know, for all their blind spots, they knew the truth on this front. I mean, we all despised the contractors. A lot of, you know, most of these guys despised the generals and even the colonels. And yeah, I mean, we all kind of acknowledged that the mission was fucked and that this was just continuing to carry on for reasons, you know, that were very self-interested and not at all related to the official reasons.
I think one of the moments in your conversion later in the book is when you go back to the U.S. after your tour, and you find that not just the suburbs of D.C., but even the Midwest has suddenly been filled with defense industry-related installations. It's as if millions of people are getting rich off this war, but none of them were the ones who were fighting it.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's been to a war zone, you know, in recent decades as an American, as a U.S. warfighter, will tell you about just the omnipresence of contractors. And a lot of these contractors would just straight up boast about how much they were making. I mean, oftentimes they were making 100,000, 200,000, sometimes even 300,000, 400,000 for like 3 months, 6 months stints.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, it was incredible. You would just hear this time and again, if you wanted to get the Marines to turn against or despise the contractors, this is the way to do it. And yeah, I mean, I don't think Americans have even begun to account for how much the war on terror has shaped the landscape at home. And I mean that metaphorically, but I also mean it very literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just grown, the military industrial world has just grown exponentially in the past 20 years. And you see it driving down any highway, particularly any highway or road in the greater DC area. But I would also say across the country, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there's defense contractors everywhere. There's defense-related, and also just the melding of foreign policing and domestic policing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have all sorts of just somewhat nebulous business entities dotting the landscape now that are providing services simultaneously for cops and military people and mm-hmm. contractors both domestically and abroad. And it's really disturbing. And I could really sense that when I got home. I mean, I just became so hyper aware of the landscape wherever I was, and just seeing like I would pay attention to every exit sign, and you know, they would say what was sometimes, or the buildings that I was passing.
Food, lodging, military, industrial, next exit.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not only that, though, like in your book, you do a great job of sort of, I mean, literally every stone you unturn. Once your eyes are open to that there's this, you know, a cant that is necessary to kind of organize people for empire. And it's all about, you know, humanitarianism or protecting America, or we're under threat, we're spreading great values. And then there's the reality of it, which is just grim imperialism. And every stone you start to unturn anywhere, whether it's like in your hometown or some place you're staying, there's some horrible atrocity there, or some remnant of U.S. imperialism. I mean, it sounds like this, once it kind of started hitting you when you came back in a big way, you could sort of see it. You know, it's that old, it's the they live thing, right? Starting to see it everywhere, right?
Well, Mark, I think that's something that happened to both of us, too.
Yes.
It's like when we went away from the U.S. and came back, it was a real shock. And it helped, I don't know, coming back from New Zealand, I know it helped me move away from identifying with the place.
Also, leaving Berkeley kind of helped. Yeah. I have to say, leaving Berkeley and coming back.
That's right.
Because Berkeley gave you a very distorted. Yeah. I mean, you went to Vegas, which will do it. I went to Texas. But like, it gives you a pretty distorted view of, because, you know, when we entered the Berkeley scene, I guess you'd say sort of the old liberal, you know, establishment was still, it was gone, but it was still somewhat sort of a ambient dominant. But certainly by the end of the 80s, it was done.
Speaking of the 80s and the Reagan days, I have to mention, just because it's part of the Radio War Nerd obligations, to mention any coverage of Red Dawn. So this is a passage from your book about Red Dawn. And I think it does address the complexity of the consciousness of the people who have to fight this war. You can believe and not believe. Another Stephen Stray's dimension in which we believe without belief, beyond belief. But anyway, here's this passage from your book. That night, the Marines huddle around a minuscule laptop to watch the original Red Dawn, starring Patrick Swayze, the Reagan-era cult classic about a counterfactual Soviet invasion of the continental United States and the ragtag guerrilla resistance it inspires. You know we're the imperialist invaders this time, fellas. Oh, hell yeah, sir, Walker says. We watched Star Wars the other night. Same deal. We're all about it.
That's hilarious. Didn't Lucas write it as a protest movie against the Vietnam War? The Viet Cong are the freedom fighters and we're the stormtroopers. Yep.
That's it. That part is amazing. Yeah. I saw this in people during this era of imperialism. That's like, you can be for the invasion and not of Iraq and not have any plans to serve or to go. You can cheer for the moment in Aliens when the corporate executive gets tossed in a closet with the alien, and then go into corporate law. I mean, people are very complicated about how they handle their allegiances.
There's another scene where I'm talking about a logistics guy who's running convoys his entire time in Afghanistan, and he was a 9/11 truther.
Wow.
he was a 9/11 truther who believed his own government had murdered thousands of Americans. And then he also had joined up and was gladly serving in that very government's military in Afghanistan. Wow. So, I mean, I would come across this all the time. I mean, there was this kind of this distance, this intellectual distance, or even like ironic distance from the politics of the war. Like everyone, again, I think there was a difference between the flagpole Marines that were close to the generals and colonels, or were the generals and colonels, and the frontline guys. But certainly among the frontline guys, there's this kind of ironic distance from the actual politics of the war. We all agreed it was fucked. And we disagree on why it was fucked. I should say, I don't want to like totally superimpose my own politics on all my, the guys I worked with, because we didn't all have the same politics. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of people who thought it was fucked because the rules of engagement were too rigid. And if only we were given the ability to just kill everyone, then somehow
the old Vietnam War complaint. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you would hear that too. But I mean, everyone agreed that it was fucked in one way or another. And they didn't trust their own government. I mean, that was the real irony. No one really trusted the very government that was giving them their orders. And at the same time, they had this incredibly heartfelt connection to the people. I mean, this is cliche, but it's like you said earlier, a lot of cliches happen to be true. Mm-hmm. And this is a true one. You know, they were incredibly emotionally and psychologically invested in the people around them and in the, in what they were doing at a very micro level. There was this kind of just, there was what's happening at the macro level, which everyone treated with scorn. And then there was what was happening at the micro level, which was often narrated in very romantic, heartfelt ways.
One thing I wanted to ask too, and I know we've kept you a long time, so we'll try to limit any more questions. But especially earlier on in the book, you make a lot of links between you know, for lack of a better, you know, the phrase, the popular phrase now, like toxic masculinity and imperialism and a culture that supports imperialism and war. And I think we've said this a lot on this show. I mean, a lot of times it is as simple. I mean, young males are toxic almost as a rule to one degree or another. Or it's common toxic masculinity, violent thoughts, violent stupidity is pretty common in to one degree or another, smart or dumb among males. And this whole anxiety about masculinity is a much bigger deal, as we said, in sort of the 90s through sort of the early part of the 2000s among warmongers and the right and the neoconservatives and even sort of muscular liberals or whatever. But now it's different. Now, at least on the surface, and you deal with this, but I wanted to throw this out there anyway. I mean, now it's amazing how, at least at the rhetorical PR level, how adaptable the empire is. Now, actually, it is about fighting toxic masculinity and misogyny and homophobia and racism. I mean, our enemies are guilty of all those, our current official enemies are guilty of those things. I mean, as John, I think when we were talking earlier, he pointed out, you know, Chris Hitchens was one of the earlier, coming from the left, was one of the earlier kind of pushers of this new rhetoric, saying, you know, we're going into Iraq to fight misogyny.
Well, yeah, it was actually Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, right.
Yeah. So now some of the, he was talking about, you know, Pashtun patriarchs, really. Mm-hmm. Some of the men who stone women to death for adultery right. are going to be bombed by female pilots in the right. most advanced fighter jets in the world. So that it was, you know, this is a triumph for feminism in, right. in his version of it.
I mean, I just want your sort of take on this because you've looked into this a lot. It's sort of, I mean, at the root of it all is, you know, again, another cliche, but white male supremacy, but it can take the form of its supposed opposite, or it can borrow anything from kind of its left critics and still promulgate the same structure and power. I mean, is that somewhere where you were kind of going with the book as well? Like, because it is kind of remarkable just how, you know, with the CIA doing the rainbow flags and Lockheed doing rainbow. It's really remarkable how flexible this empire is. But at the root, it doesn't really change. I mean, it reminds me of one thing, an old friend of mine, a Mexican-American guy, big lawyer in Silicon Valley. Or, you know, we would talk about this. And, I don't know, I was going off on Silicon Valley at one point. And he just said to me, he's like, because Silicon Valley, up until maybe 5 years ago, pretended to be the most progressive end of corporate America. And people believed in it, which is pretty funny. And he just said, they're all white males. Okay, I don't care. You know, you'll have a few faces that are different. I'm in there, I know. And, you know, they are all white males. The whole structure is white males and all the liberal stuff is complete bullshit. And so it's just sort of, it keeps morphing, you know? And I'm not saying this to like self-bash being a white male. I'm just curious as a fact about empire, like what you think about that, seeing that from the inside and then coming back out again.
Yeah, so first of all, I would say like Hitchens' kind of humanitarian, you know, feminist argument for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, were present at the time. I mean, Hitchens was one of the most prominent, obviously, liberal supporters of the war. So it was there. I think the major difference now is that, you know, you have the emergence of some more, you know, radical movements that, you know, more kind of leftist, mm-hmm. Kind of Bernie-style socialism.
Right.
You've got Black Lives Matter. You've got Me Too. So the empire and those at the heights of the empire, both within the government and without the government in the corporate world, are responding to that, right? So mm-hmm. they're co-opting the language of these movements for their own purposes. And I think one, and it's not, by the way, it's not just the corporate world. We're seeing it in academia. We're also mm-hmm. seeing it in the nonprofit sector, even, you know, yep. Supposedly left or, you know, liberal or left nonprofit entities and so forth. And I think one of the things I wanted to do with this book, in fact, I think one of the driving reasons I wrote it is that there's just this huge disconnect when it comes to the racial discourse and the gender discourse and the way that the mainstream, and unfortunately even outside the mainstream, even on the left, talks about war and militarism and imperialism, if they choose to talk about those things at all. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to connect the discourse on America's racial history and the mm-hmm. discourse on patriarchy with American imperialism, because mm-hmm. I think gender and race are absolutely central to American foreign policy and to American militarism and to the whole economic model of the United States, both domestically and globally. And it's hard, those connections are hardly talked about at all across the spectrum. And yeah, I mean, there's just something so fundamentally absurd about the CIA, appropriating these radical languages of queerness or feminism or, you know, anti-racism and seeing this in the corporate world, because of course the entire structure that these institutions represent and lead are based on incredibly, you know, hyper-masculine, racialized, even racist assumptions about the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically, there's two kind of presiding assumptions that all these organizations operate from. One is that the United States, and particularly the ruling elites in the United States, are more deserving of power and all the wealth that comes with that than the rest of the world, particularly in the global South, and that the U.S.-led institutions and the global North as a whole must therefore maintain and expand this power and wealth, because without this status quo continuing, there'll be total chaos in the world. Because
or yellow peril.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
The China threat, it threatens that. Yeah, and it's like very,
of course,
barely under the surface that exactly what you're saying is sort of the argument.
Yeah,
about,
exactly. And then assumption, the second assumption is that, you know, the world is a world of, you know, chaos, and that mm-hmm. it's the only thing stopping this chaos from leading to total global annihilation is not just the United States, not just the global North, not just global capitalism, but people within the global North, within these capitalist structures that are willing to be strong enough to defend that order.
Yeah, selflessly.
And it's just,
they
yeah,
just happen
course,
to have mansions, but yeah, otherwise
yeah.
selflessly.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, we're still living in a time where it's, you know, even Joe Biden, who, you know, relative to previous presidents has, you know, actually moved the foreign policy in a direction that I hope it continues to move in. But even he speaks in this language yep. of just like hyper-masculine strength, and everything's about being strong or being yeah. weak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's there's something just so absurd about these same people and these same institutions suddenly pretending that they're part of a Me Too movement or an anti-racist movement. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to, you know, expose that. I mean, mm-hmm. in my own little small, tiny corner of the world. Mm-hmm. And all, you know, both hope to get people that do see themselves as genuinely part of these movements and on the left to think more critically and more right. regularly about American empire and its relationship to these other, to race and gender, and also get people in the center to maybe at least feel that, make them feel a little less comfortable
yeah.
about the two-step that they're engaged in.
Yeah, that's why I like that you put up another quote from the late 90s that people have forgotten, or at least I'd forgotten, that there was so much of this bloodthirsty big talk. This is Tom Friedman in 1999. The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. That's suave what he did with McDonald's. and McDonnell Douglas, the builder of the F-15, and the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies is called the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. I mean, I don't think Tom Friedman has ever met a fist in his life, but yeah, okay.
Or thrown one. I mean, yeah, I mean, he absolutely. And he, you know, a few years later.
Suck on this. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he has a history of this. I mean, which was just so sexualized. I mean, that interview with who was it? Who was it with?
Charlie Rose. Speaking of sexualized. Later,
exactly.
Yeah. That was one of the most absurd interviews. Tom Friedman, you know, not exactly one's classical Hollywood idea of toxic masculinity, getting as toxically masculine as he possibly can, you know. We need to go right in
puffing
there.
Puffing up, like.
Yes. Arching his back and letting his hair, you know, his mustache go up. that was bizarre. There's a lot of bizarre moments, but you know, another thing, I mean, John keeps going back and quoting some of this. I'm really glad you put in some of these old quotes because, like, for example, there were other quotes you had of, it might have been Kelly or some other top Marine people talking about America, the enemies that we face in the global war on terror, which is now already a bad memory. It seems like the whole military, the whole culture, the political culture, everyone wants to forget it because it became such a bummer. Of course, it was a losing bummer. It had no purpose. It was making the military, you know, it was good for business for a long time, but it was kind of causing ideological sort of problems. And, but the way they talked about the enemy then is so familiar again today. Like, I don't have the quote in front of me, but, you know, the enemy we face is unlike any threat the U.S. has ever faced, you know, greater threat than ever because they don't fight the way we fight. They hate our way of life. They're so different from us. They don't play by rules. And we need to save this fragile experiment in democracy. They always say, like, America, this country that rules the world, 800 bases around the world, you know, in 100 plus countries, it's been this form of government and this rickety old constitution for 200 and God knows 30, 40 years now. And they always say, it's this experiment, this fragile experiment. I mean, it would be like, you know, I don't know, like some king in the Middle Ages talking about kingdoms as a fragile experiment that, you know, might collapse. I mean, it's really absurd. But the way they talked about this enemy unlike any other, and then you just erase global war on terror, erase that we're, you know, waging this racist war on Muslims and so on. And then you just say, Russia is unlike, for example, and China, unlike any enemy we've ever faced. They use Maskirovka and deception and hybrid warfare and things we, a fragile experiment democracy, aren't ready for this. Like, we're always the underdog, even though, you know, as you said in that, we're the Death Star, we're the stormtroopers, but we always have to kind of paint ourselves as the underdog, and every new enemy is unlike any enemy we ever faced, the greatest danger we ever faced. I mean, it's just nothing, you know, as Walter would say, nothing fucking changes, dude.
I just want to say something about that. So I think one of the reasons gender ended up becoming so central to my book, there's a lot of reasons, but one reason is that I was writing at the time, the age of Trump, the age of people like Kanye and Elon Musk. So all these men who are trying to be really manly, who are just so transparently, like, ridiculous
in
every sense of that word, and so fragile and so insecure. So, you know, I was writing about myself and how this kind of dynamic was very present in myself, particularly when I was younger. And, I think it always is to some degree, this relationship between just extreme forms of insecurity and therefore extreme needs to present yourself as always strong and hyper secure and endowed with this ability to defend yourself and your women, basically. And, you know, there's all these men that were, you know, just so central to the discourse in 2019, 2020, up to the present. And at the same time, you were seeing this same thing like in the foreign policy discourse. I mean, like you just gave one example, but you constantly see this. Like we're simultaneously the strongest, most powerful, most competent, most indispensable nation the world has ever known. And we're also the most fragile, the most insecure, the most terrified of everything.
We're hanging by a thread, this fragile experiment. We're always hanging by a thread.
There's just such a clear connection between like our own personal pathos and our political pathos as a society. And I really wanted to just hit that point home.
I think you did that.
That neurosis. It's a great book and a great interview, and really appreciate you coming on and talking with us and spending this time. And we want to tell our listeners, subscribers, check out Lyle Jeremy Rubin's book, Pain is Weakness, Leaving the Body, which is, I have to say, there were a few of those. I mean, it's a Marine saying, and it's pretty damn impressive. There were some Marine sayings that were pretty, speaking of poetry, poetic. I thought they were pretty impressive. Like, and that one is, I mean, it's frightening, right?
Yeah.
But it's a pretty effective line. Pain is weakness, leaving the body. A great title for a book, too.
Yeah. And thank you very much for this interview. It was great.
Yeah, I really appreciated this. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes our interview with Lyle Jeremy Rubin. We'll post a link to his book and maybe even a couple articles. His book, Pain is Weakness, Leaving the Body, just came out. And again, thanks to Lyle. Thanks, John. And talk to everyone soon.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.